Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page and check out the regional event in Northwest Arkansas. It's a two-day event. It's only $99. It's April 22nd and 23rd. It's going to be a lot of fun. Chad Bird's going to be there. I'm going to be there. A whole bunch of other people are going to be there. You can see the whole lineup if you go over to the website and click on it. It's going to be full of music, teaching, fellowship, food, all the things that you love. And so make it happen. Come hang out with all of us. We'd love to spend that weekend with you. Chad, we left off with Rehoboam getting some terrible advice from some young men, ignoring some good advice from some old men. And we kind of let the cat out of the bag, or the scorpion out of the bag, as it were, that he is going to go ahead and deliver some bad words to the people of Israel, and we're going to find out how this is going to serve him.
Yeah, we left him with 3 days to consider his options. He's got the old men telling him basically, hey, if you'll be a servant leader, then everybody's going to follow behind you. They're going to be your servants. Everything will go well. And then we have the young guys saying, no, what you need to do is tell them, yeah, get in behind me or else.
You get the impression that Rehoboam has an ego on him, like, and that the idea that the people even began with a request was offensive to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of just being happy that he was their new king, they said, things are rough under your dad, so please make it a little bit easier on us. Instead of simply saying, we're so happy that you're king, stroking his ego, making him feel like he was the most important person in the room. They didn't do that, and the request they had was not that great. They weren't asking for a lot. They just simply said, hey, lighten the load. That's all we're asking.
I think it kind of, it's like this, you know, if you're standing up there and you got an ego on you, and the first thing that people ask you to do is to reduce taxes or whatever it is, and then they qualify it with, and then we will serve you. I think in Rehoboam's mind right now, he's like, oh, you're going to serve me whether I do that or not. I think that's the part that's really offensive. It's not so much that they might have something they want him to do, but did you just make you serving me conditional? And I think that this is something that he doesn't like that at all.
Yeah, conditional servitude is not something that most kings like to hear.
Mm-hmm.
They like to think that I have all the authority, so whether you like it or not, you're going to serve me.
Yes. Yeah. So Rehoboam's sitting there thinking, you don't have any other options, and we'll see how that goes.
We'll see how they did. Yeah. So picking up here with 1 Kings 12:12, Jeroboam, who again is a spokesman of these people, they come to Rehoboam the third day. So he's had time to deliberate, and here is his choice. The king said, the king answered the people harshly, forsaking the counsel that the old men had given him. He spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men. And here's what he said. Now, he's not going to quote his young friends verbatim. In fact, the whole manhood reference that we talked about in the last episode, he's gonna omit that. I guess maybe even Rehoboam thought that was maybe going a little bit too far to compare his manhood to his father. So he does omit that part. But he does say this: my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. So, in other words, a big fat no to their quest. And not only that, but not even a veiled threat, an overt threat that he will make life even more difficult for these people. Because, as you said, Dan, because they wanted to make their servitude conditional. So, verse 15 states the obvious. So the king did not listen to the people. For, now this is significant, it was a turn of affairs. That word only occurs here, that Hebrew word only occurs here, could also be translated something like maybe twist. There was a twist in the narrative, as it were, a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord, that he might fulfill his word, which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So God had already promised Jeroboam through the prophet that this was going to happen. And as, of course, the Lord is always doing, he is working in the midst of sinners saying ridiculous things and making stupid decisions in order that his will might be done, which of course is a tremendous comfort to us. It means that God is going to make sure that his story is written, even though we are in our own stories, messing things up all the time, making dumb and rash decisions, as indeed Rehoboam had done. So all of this was eventually nothing more than the fulfillment of what God had already said would happen when he spoke to Jeroboam through the prophet. So, verse 16, when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, "What portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, David." Now, what's remarkable about this is almost verbatim lifted from an earlier part of David's life. So you may remember in 1 Samuel 20, it was when everything was kind of falling apart for David. It's when his son Absalom had rebelled, and we had the coup that ended up being a failed coup, and Absalom was killed, and David was heartbroken. Well, right after that, we have a rebellion that was led by a guy named Sheba, who was from the tribe of Benjamin. He's called a worthless man in 1 Samuel 20. And he blew the trumpet and said, now this is the quote that's almost repeated here in 1 Kings 12. He said, "We have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So you had a division in the kingdom under the time of David that was led by this worthless guy named Sheba. Well, you have the same thing happening here, except in this case, it's legitimate. This portion of David they're talking about here, of course, is the royal line of David, of which Rehoboam is now the one who's received that. He's sitting on the throne of David. And they're saying, "Listen, we are officially and completely separating from you. We have no more portion in David's royal line, no inheritance of the son of Jesse. Instead, we're going to our own house. We're going to our own place." And that is exactly what we're told happened next. Israel went to their tents. So this proclamation on their part is basically saying, since you're not going to lighten the load, then we are going to separate from you. This is a complete fissure in the life of Israel. Now we have the beginning of the division of the kingdoms, which will never be repaired until the coming of the Messiah. So the division begins here in 1 Kings 12, verse 16. Verse 17 says, Rehoboam reigned over the people of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah. Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was taskmaster over the forced labor, and all Israel stoned him to death. So you talk about the ego of Rehoboam. After this had happened, after the people had rejected him as king, after they had said, "We have no inheritance in you," he still thought that he was going to be able to force his hand. I guess this was his version of whipping them with scorpions. It's like, "Oh, well, I'm going to show you. I'll just send my guy."
Yeah. Yeah. That didn't work out.
It didn't work out so well. This Adoram is called by other names. He's called Adoram. He's called Hadoram. He's called a couple of other names. Probably it's all in reference to the same guy. He was the one in charge of the forced labor. So Rehoboam sends him, no doubt to kind of get the people in shape, tell them what they should be doing, get them in line. Well, they respond by killing him. And I was thinking when I read this morning, how long has it been since we've had reference in the Old Testament to a stoning? Because you hear a lot about it back in the Torah, because, you know, people are wanting to stone Moses to death. There's some executions that are carried out against people who have broken the law. The last time that anybody, at least in recorded biblical history, the last time anybody was stoned to death was all the way back in the days of Joshua, when Achan took the stuff from the city of Jericho, and they stoned him to death and heaped over his body all those stones in the valley of Achor, the valley of trouble. No record of any stoning since then, which I think is the Bible's way of winking to us, telling us, hey, we're kind of going back again to the beginning, more of this kind of regression that we talked about in the last episode. We're going back here to earlier days in Israel's history. So you have Rehoboam, who was a Pharaoh-like character. He hardens his heart against the people's request, just like when Moses came to Pharaoh and said, "Let the people go, you know, reduce this servitude upon them, break this yoke that you placed upon them." And he said no. So Jeroboam, the Moses figure, comes to Rehoboam, the Pharaoh figure, and says the same thing. And when he says no and says, I'm going to make it even worse, which is exactly what Pharaoh in Egypt did. Remember, he took away their straw. He made life even more burdensome for them, made their yoke even heavier. That's what Rehoboam threatens to do. So what do you have? Well, you once more have kind of an exodus happening, which seems to me is what this, at least in the big biblical picture, this should be thought of as. So Jeroboam, the Moses-like character, is leading the people of Israel, which here would be the 10 northern tribes. He's leading them out from underneath the yoke of Egyptian-like slavery under Rehoboam in this exile that takes them to the northern country. So this is like another exodus taking place. So in this case, the Pharaoh character, who's Rehoboam, tries once more to get the people in line to make them do what he wants them to do. And they turn on him. They stone this guy to death with stones. They execute him. So again, it's kind of this idea of putting to death the enemies of God's people, those who were trying to subject him to slavery.
It seems, too, that stoning this guy to death is a community execution. So if he shows up and then somebody kills him, then you can point to one person and say, that guy killed that guy, and this can get back to Rehoboam. And they can be, okay, so who is responsible for this? Stoning someone is when the community comes together and executes a verdict on you. Mm-hmm. I think it sends a different message. Right? We stoned that dude to death. Like we did.
Yes.
Like we killed him. And there's not one person. We didn't just send some guy out there with a sword and hack him down. We got together and everyone picked up a stone and we killed this guy. And you can't pin that on any particular person. There's a lot of stones involved in a stoning. And so this is the entire community is rejecting this.
Yeah. And because of that, of course, it sends an even stronger message to Rehoboam. Yeah. There's not just like a few ne'er-do-wells out there who are not going to reject your reign. This is everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody is unhappy with you. Everybody came to you and made a request, which you rejected. You threatened them. And so they are going to respond in this sort of way, in this very unmissable kind of way. You can't misinterpret what they did to this guy.
No.
If they are angry enough to execute him in this sort of way, then you know that things are falling apart for you.
Yeah, it seems like they don't want the message to go back to Rehoboam that, hey, you sent your guy here. Somebody killed him. That's not the message they want to send.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody was involved in this. Everybody had stone in their hand. And we're told in the second half of verse 18 that finally, I mean, it took a while, but finally the message must have got through because Rehoboam hurried to mount his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. Now, I don't know if he was actually there and maybe saw things coming undone and took off, or maybe he was somewhere else. And message was brought to him saying, hey, you know what the people did to Adoram? They took him out. They stoned him. Either way, whether he was actually close by when this happened or whether he was somewhere else and heard about it, he realizes that he's got to get to Jerusalem. So he gets in his chariot. He flees to the capital city. And then verse 19 says, so Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. So a bit of historical perspective there added by the author. It's been a long time happening, and here is really where it all began. Verse 20 says, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. There was none that followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. And again, this is one of these cases. In fact, the very next verse will tell us that the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. So when you hear the tribe of Judah, just kind of assume that the tribe of Benjamin is implied in that as well. So here we have the fulfillment, at least the beginning of the fulfillment, of what Ahijah had told Jeroboam would happen. He's received the 10 northern tribes, and he has been made king over all Israel. So this is going to be the beginning of this long list of kings in the north and the south. And for the rest of 1 Kings, and at least for the majority of 2 Kings, what we're going to be doing is basically sometimes talking about what's happening in the north with their particular king at the time. Sometimes be talking about what happened in the south with their particular king at the time. And sometimes these stories will be intermingled, because the way that Kings tells the story is it kind of goes back and forth. It'll talk, oh, it's, here's what's happening in the north. Okay, here's what's happening in the south. And sometimes they're actually at peace with each other, and often they are at odds with each other. But there's always, at least until 2 Kings 17, there's always two stories being told. There's the north story, and then there's the south story. And each of these, of course, are going to have their kings, some of which reign quite a while, some of which have very, very short reigns. But at the beginning, we've got north under Jeroboam. We have south under Rehoboam, two different kings. And as we'll see in just a minute, we're actually going to have two different worship sites as well. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. So first of all, we're told is that Rehoboam, once he gets back to Jerusalem, maybe, you know, he got over his initial fear upon hearing about the stoning of Adoram. And he decides, you know, the best thing for me to do is to flex my military might and go attack the north and make sure that they realize that they made a big mistake in rebelling against me. So he goes to Jerusalem. He gets together all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. There's that inclusion again. 180,000 chosen warriors to fight against the house of Israel to restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. So that's his goal. He's going to basically force them into submission because they rebelled. I mean, this is a civil war, more or less. That's beginning. But, verse 22, the word of God came to a guy we have not heard of so far. He's introduced to us here, Shemaiah, the man of God. So, seers or prophets are called by various names. In the older days, they were called seers, and then it was more like a Navi, which means prophet. But sometimes seers or prophets are also called a man of God. Now, today, in kind of church speak, if we talk about, oh, he's a true man of God, we usually use that to mean, you know, someone who's really faithful, a very pious person. In the Old Testament, a man of God is frequently just kind of an official kind of designation for the spokesperson of God, so a prophet. So Shemaiah is a man of God. He's a prophet. And this word of God came to him, and it said that he was to say to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, thus says the Lord. So kind of typical introduction here. Word of God comes to him and says, here are the addressees. These are the people to whom you are to talk. Judah, Benjamin, and the rest of the people, whoever that is. Maybe it's foreign mercenaries, maybe it's Gentiles who are part of the tribe of Judah now. Whoever it is, those are the addressees. And here's what you are to say. Thus says the Lord, you shall not go up or fight against your relatives, the people of Israel. Every man return to his home, for this thing is from me. So they listened to the word of the Lord and went home again according to the word of the Lord. Literally, when it says this thing is from me, that it's devar in Hebrew, which is the same thing translated in the next part of the verse as word. So we could say, for this word is from me. So they listened to the word of the Lord and went home again according to the word of the Lord. So God is saying through Shemaiah, the man of God or the prophet, listen, don't go trying to attack the north. They're your brothers. Instead, what has happened, everything that has happened, is something that I have predetermined should happen. And so the status quo, the situation in which you now find yourself, is what I myself set up to happen. He doesn't tell them all the details about how he set this up with Ahijah and Jeroboam, but he's basically saying, listen, the way things are now, that is my divine will. That is what I myself caused to happen. And so to rebel against this, to engage in civil war, is to engage in war against what I myself have willed to take place.
You might wonder if Rehoboam is kind of relieved that this is the case, because it does seem like this is something he probably feels like he has to do. Like, all right, I got to get the army together and go in there. They just killed this guy. And I'm sure he's freaked out about it. Then you have this prophet show up and be like, nah, don't do that. And because he does seem like he gives in rather easily to this. And he is not a guy that we have seen so far. We don't have a ton of evidence, but the little evidence we have is not a man that takes good advice quickly. And so it could be that he was thinking he this is something that he must do, and now he's been told he doesn't have to do that, and he says, okay, God, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, he probably is a little bit relieved. And, you know, if he's anything like his dad, he really doesn't have military experience because mm-hmm. this has been a time of peace.
Right.
So it's not like these guys are David-like fighting against enemy forces on a regular basis. So he's not probably not experienced in warfare. So not knowing exactly what would happen. Yeah, he's probably relieved. And so for that reason, he actually does what the prophet says in this case. So that we're going to kind of set aside Rehoboam now, and we're going to focus on Jeroboam, and we're going to see what he does in during his reign. And really, verses 25 through the end of the chapter are going to be the, in some ways, kind of the, what would you call it? Sort of the funeral announcement, way ahead of the death that's going to take place. So this already at the beginning of the Northern Kingdom. This is the beginning of the end. In some ways, what we're about to describe is already the death of the Northern Kingdom, because this is a mortal wound from which they will never recover. It will haunt them the rest of their days. So this also will become just kind of emblematic of what's been wrong with the Northern Kingdom all along. And you will have no kings who really recover from this. So you got some good kings in the south on occasion, no real true good kings that are in the north. So what are we talking about? Well, let's get to it. We're told, first of all, just a couple of building projects that Jeroboam was engaged in. He built, probably here you should understand this as fortified. He said he built Shechem, but Shechem already existed. So probably more like he built onto it, or he fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim. And he lived there, Shechem being the very place where beforehand they had gathered to talk to Rehoboam, try and get him to relieve some of their burdens. So he rebuilt, or he fortified Shechem, and he went out from there, and he again built, we're told, Penuel. This Penuel is the same place that's sometimes referred to as Peniel. This is where Jacob had his famous wrestling match with the messenger of the Father back in Genesis chapter 32. It was this place that Gideon destroyed when they didn't give him help when he's pursuing his enemies. So it has a long history going all the way back to Genesis. So for whatever reason, Jeroboam crossed into the Transjordan area, and he built or rebuilt Peniel or Penuel. Then, so he's a couple of building projects there. Then we're told these ominous words. Jeroboam said in his heart. Now, I've never done a word search of that, but I would guess just off the top of my head that anytime somebody says in their heart something, it's probably not going to be good.
That's right.
Certainly in this case, it's not going to be good. So keep in mind, as you listen to what he says in his heart, he's already heard with his ears the objective, sure word of God that came to him from the prophet Ahijah. So God has already said, this is what I'm going to do. Now Jeroboam is going to say something else in his heart.
Well, what you have is, so the word of the Lord comes to Jeroboam from a prophet. That word has come to pass. So he has every reason to trust that word. That word, like this is a fairly unlikely thing, has happened exactly the way that this prophet has said it would happen. Now, the other word that the prophet said was, whatever you do, don't get some idols. I'm going to need you to walk the way David walked and not do that. And what Jeroboam is going to say in his heart is, I should do the exact opposite of that.
That's precisely right, yeah.
It's wild.
It is wild. So God said this, okay, and this has come to be, right? God promised me this. God has made it happen. But, you know, I hear a different word. I hear fear. I hear misgivings. I hear different plans in my own heart. And so I'm gonna do that. I mean, this is kind of isn't this like the classic sinner's move? God says this, but I like this word better. God says that, but I like what I'm hearing in my heart. What I'm hearing in my heart makes more sense. This is kind of a classic sola scriptura argument here. Listen, stick with what God says. Stick with his word. And don't go listening to what you hear in your heart, especially when what you hear in your heart is directly opposed to what God himself has said. Okay, well, let's see what he heard in his heart. Verse 26, Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." Now, what made him think this?
Yeah.
I mean, this on the surface is kind of strange because the people, obviously, that are under him don't like Rehoboam. I mean, they rebelled against him. They initiated this break between North and South. So why in the world would they want to go back under Rehoboam? The only thing I can understand, kind of trying to think the way that Jeroboam is thinking, is Jeroboam is saying to himself, listen, I know that the temple in Jerusalem is at the heart of our faith. And people are supposed to go there at least three times a year for Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles. Well, if they start doing that, if their religious devotion is to the temple in Jerusalem, then maybe their political devotion will be as well. You know, if they go to church there, then maybe they're going to vote for the guy over there. It's kind of the idea.
Well, I think that I think he believes that that Rehoboam has a massive chess piece in Jerusalem. He's not so much worried about the affections of the people going toward Rehoboam, but he is worried that the affections of the people are very much attached to Jerusalem, and that Rehoboam has a move he can make, which is just to not allow them to do that anymore, and that this is a fear that the people might have.
You know, I had never thought about this until this very moment here, but I wonder if also kind of what's going on here is who built the temple. Well, this was a national building project, right? So probably some of the people that are now under Jeroboam actually helped to build the temple in Jerusalem. So you can imagine, you know, it's kind of a special place. Apart from the whole religious part of it, he's probably got a special place in their heart just because, hey, I helped build that.
Yeah, he's,
or at the very least, maybe my son or my uncle or my taxes or whatever. Mm-hmm. Listen, I have an investment in the temple in Jerusalem because of my own personal or family or tribal history. And so it's pretty hard to break yourself away from that. And so you can see how Jeroboam is kind of, you know, he's a politician, he's thinking things through, and he's like, but, you know, there's a chance, a good chance possibly, that if they keep going there, well then, yeah, like you said, it's a big chess piece that Rehoboam has.
Yeah, yeah, I think he's very nervous about him making the move of cutting them off from the temple, which is, they might not give a crap about, you know, Rehoboam, but they really care about the temple.
Yeah, that's what this all boils down to. So what's he going to do then? You know, this is what he says in his heart. These are his fears. So he's, you know, he's still got some options. You can say things in your heart and not act on them, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things that pass through my mind and heart that, thank God, I don't act on. But Jeroboam does. He doesn't just say this to himself. He doesn't just think this or feel this fear. He is going to act on it. And verses 28 and following tells us what he does. It says, the king took counsel and made two calves of gold.
I already know that this counsel is terrible.
Yeah, you don't need to read any further. This was some bad counsel.
Why are you making golden calves, man?
Yeah.
Of all the things.
This is as a rule of thumb, if anybody ever suggests making golden calves under any circumstances whatsoever, it's a bad idea.
Yeah, of all the things to choose.
Yeah, it's a wild choice, and not only that, but not only the making of the two calves of gold, but what he says. So it goes on to, after the two calves of gold are made, he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough." Idea. You know what? I'm going to make it a lot easier on you. "Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." This is Exodus 32 all over again. Mm-hmm. In fact, let me read you this. This is Exodus 32, verses 4 and 5. So kind of still keep listening to the words I just read to you from 1 Kings 12. Now Exodus 32. Aaron received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." So what you have in 1 Kings 12 is not only a replica of the very same golden calf that was made at the foot of Mount Sinai, but you also have here an almost verbatim quote of what was said about that golden calf in Exodus 32. The only difference being really now you have two of them instead of one. Now, and we probably talked about this. It's been too many years since we've covered Exodus 32, so I'm sure we talked about this back then. But here is what I think is going on here. First of all these Israelites knew who brought them out of the land of Egypt. They knew that Yahweh had brought them out of the land of Egypt, right? This, I mean, that's kind of you can't get much more foundational and creedal than that. So Jeroboam is not saying to them, what I want you to do is completely change your gods. Now your God's going to be these golden calves. I know before it was Yahweh, and that was good for centuries, but now we're going to switch. Now it's going to be these golden calves. Why do I say that? Because very often in the iconography of the ancient Near East, cows or bulls were used as the iconic pedestals for a god. So we actually have little statues that archaeologists have found where the god is standing on the back of a bull or the back of a calf. This was understood to be kind of the divine mount, if you will. So probably what was happening in Exodus 32 and what was happening here in 1 Kings 12 is there was an attempt to use a golden calf, which symbolically was inextricably linked with idolatry, with Canaanite religion, to use that as a pedestal for Yahweh. So this is classic syncretism, trying to mix together into kind of a new religious cocktail, two different religions, two different ways of thinking about and picturing who Yahweh is. But you can't do that without leading to deadly and disastrous and idolatrous consequences.
You can't do it without breaking the commandment that says don't have graven images. Yeah. It's real explicit. Yeah, I don't know if he's thinking like, well, there ain't no Moses around that's going to come and reprimand me for this. So maybe, you know, he looked at Aaron and said, that was a pretty good idea. Moses just kind of blew the whole thing up. It seems to me, you know, if you're going to do something like this, like, again, it's wild that you would choose the thing that has been chosen before and ended so badly. It seems that would be enough to give you pause no matter what symbolism you were trying to attach to it. You're like, well, look, everybody knows that this didn't go well. Why don't you make a gold staff with a serpent on it, or make a gold pillar, you know, something.
Like anything.
You know, like how about the pillar of fire, you know, like make that or something. The calf is just the worst of all ideas. I mean, not that any of those other things would have been good to make either, because this is not what God wants you to do. But just strategically speaking, I just feel like the people, even though the people doesn't seem to affect him that much. They seem more than willing to go along with this, but I guess maybe he knew that too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it'd be like someone trying to use the swastika again, you know, and pretending as if it's going to not have all of that negative connotation connected to it. It's a strange choice that seems irrational, but on the other hand, you know, isn't this kind of the typical way that sinners go? You know, we are repeatedly repeating the mistakes of the past, often, in fact, replicating them in exactly the same way that it happened before. So that's the same thing that's happening here. So we have once more golden calves, two of them in this case, that are linked with Yahweh, who brought them up out of the land of Egypt, except in doing so, they are, no matter what their intentions were, they're committing idolatry because they are attempting to use this Canaanite image in connection with the Lord. And anytime you have that, I mean, you can't expect to mix poison with something that's okay and drink it and think this, the okay part is going to affect you. The poison is going to affect you. That's what what's going to happen here. So we set one up in Bethel, one of the golden calves in Bethel, which is in the south, the southern part of the northern kingdom. And the other he put in Dan. On that my recent trip to Israel, I was at Dan. And we were actually probably about 20 yards from where they've uncovered the altar and the sanctuary area where the golden calf would have been.
Hmm.
It was kind of an eerie, I have to admit, it was kind of an eerie place to be, especially when you know this history. I'm like standing there a stone's throw from where this golden calf had been set up, thinking to myself, this is wild. This is where everything came undone for Israel. Now, that the great irony is that Dan is a beautiful area. I mean, like water flowing everywhere. It was lush vegetation. So it's a beautiful place, and if you know the story from back in Judges, that's why they went there. That's why the tribe went there and they conquered the city, because it was a place of peace and abundance and plenty. And so they went there because, you know, it was like a little paradise. And that's still the way it is. It's a beautiful place. But in the midst of this beautiful place was this ugliness that happened. So they put one in Bethel in the south. They put one in Dan in the north. And then verse 30 says, this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. So the people are traveling to Bethel. They're traveling as far north as Dan so that they can be around these golden calves. And we're not done yet. That was certainly bad enough. But Jeroboam makes other changes too. I'm just going to read through these next three or four verses. He also made temples, literally buildings or houses, on high places, and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart. That's a kind of a reference back to what we said earlier, where he said these things in his heart. Well, these things he devised in his heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings.
Yeah, the impression here is that he's just making stuff up, right?
Pretty much, yeah. He's devising things in his own heart. He's just making stuff up. But it's all done with a very calculated purpose. He wants it to be close enough to what's happening in the South, to what they're used to religiously and liturgically, in order that it's not a radical change. At least it doesn't come across that way. And so that they can have, you know, this idea of they can be under the impression they're sort of still doing the same thing when they're doing something completely different.
Yeah.
So the golden calves, which of course are different. Then you have not just the temple in Jerusalem, but he has these temples or these sanctuaries on the high places, the Bamot. So you got that. You got two central sanctuaries with a bunch of smaller sanctuaries. And then he changes the priesthood. So, of course, priests can only be from the tribe of Levi. They can only be from the family of Aaron. But Jeroboam says, let's make priests from outside the tribe of Levi. So he's also breaking that down. And then to top it all off, he says, I know that in the south, they have in the 7th month, on the 15th day of the month, the Feast of Sukkot, which is usually translated booths or tabernacles. Well, we're going to have our own feast, but we're going to make it the 8th month on the 15th day. So he changed that up as well. So there is a seeming continuity, but the seeming continuity is all a lie, because everything that he's just done is in direct contradiction to what God had laid out very clearly multiple times in the Torah. And it's in direct contradiction, of course, to what the prophet had told him God would do for him if he remained faithful. So, in short, Jeroboam has basically ruined everything right from the beginning. And any chance he had of actually having a sure house that God had promised him, like the house of David, he destroyed from the very beginning, because, in essence, he listened to the word in his own heart instead of listening to the word that God had given him externally through the prophet.
Yeah, and it seems like this is all rooted in fear of losing power, fear of not being able to cling to the things that you have, And so this causes you to distrust the word that you have and do things that you come up with. You think of things, you devise ways to hold on to these things. And we're going to find out exactly how that goes as we head into chapter 13 next week, where the man of God has some words for Jeroboam concerning all this.
Yep. It'll be good.
All right, Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you then.